Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizens. Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Andre Rodatis, and I'm your host today. And with me is my co-host, Chuck Thurston. Good morning, Chuck.
Hey, Andre. Good morning. Hello, everyone.
Good morning. How are you doing this fine morning?
Good morning. I'm doing okay. Looking forward to this study.
Me too.
Yeah,
we are down by 50% this morning.
That's normally true, when
we're down this far, we decide we're not going to do it. But Chuck said, oh, come on, we can do it. So I said, okay.
We'll
charge forward. So Paula and Glenn and all, I believe, are visiting her wonderful grandchild out in Indianapolis, and Marvin, we can do a little promo for him. Some of you may have seen that there is a UAI presentation, and that is coming up just 2 hours from now. For those of you that are interested, you probably received an invitation. But if you can get into the chat, I will go ahead and post the link for that UAI Zoom presentation in the chat. Marvin will be presenting on the family of God, and that should be a very enjoyable presentation, something he studied for decades, frankly. I was part of his original study group that he used to conduct in Boulder back in the day. Back in the 80s, actually, at the Boulder School on Saturday mornings, we would have a two-hour study group, maybe three, on the socialization of religion. So Marvin has gleaned a lot from those many years of study and from his own private study, as well as his many years in some of the first Urantia social groups that were trying to move off independently from the Urantia Brotherhood at the time and others that were being conducted by the likes of Vern Grimsley with the Family of God. And lot of history there. Anyway, we wish him well in that presentation, and that will be in 2 hours. Again, a UAI presentation. I'll try and get more detail toward the end of our show. But we are on the Lanunandek rulers in our continuing study of the local universe Sons of God. And Chuck, mm-hmm. do you have anything you want to reprise from any of the week's previous studies? Obviously, I've missed a couple of weeks. I was on vacation.
Well,
what
would
you like to mention? Yeah.
Well, it was just occurring to me as we're getting started here that part of what we're looking at, especially in this paper and maybe in some others, but is the availability of visible superhuman presence on the planet. You know, whether that's part of our planetary experience or not. And clearly it's intended to be, but for the reasons of the rebellion, mainly, we've been deprived of that. You know, well, Jesus, I guess, was the last visible superhuman, but he was also human. So he's like us, well, and divine. But that would make Machiavenna maybe the last visible superhuman on the planet in a full sense. So some of these beings can make themselves visible, others can't, but they're all associated with, particularly the Lanunandek, with a very present regime on the planet, which is now gone. But I think everybody's looking forward to the possibility of once again having some kind of visible superhuman representation, some representation of the administration of the universe visible on this planet. And that's just a thought to kind of hold out there as we read about these types of beings, because in some ways they're involved with those kinds of possibilities. So that's one thing
they all have been thinking about a little bit. Right. I mean, it's very interesting the range of function and how they all have their realms of expertise, and that while mm-hmm. Melchizedek's, for instance, are regarded as higher than the Verondedex and the Lonanandex, in that sense, and I'm using air quotes here, for higher.
Well, they were created
prior. Well, they were created prior, but they also were created with greater versatility and we are told that they come and they literally were created between mortals and the Ancients of Days, which they don't say in the same way about the Verondedex and the Lanunandek.
They're at that midpoint.
Yeah. So when they do that, go ahead. Why don't you make your point?
No. I just go ahead. I was just affirming what you're saying. Because that was an interesting thing.
I just
came across that recently. Yeah. And I thought that was interesting.
Sure.
I wasn't quite sure the full meaning of that, being at that midway mm-hmm. position. But I'm curious if you have another thought about that.
Well, I think it implies created at a higher level of spirituality. I think that's the first thing to assume, that they are higher order spiritual beings. But at the same time, you know, they're created with a latitude of function that is quite broad. And they're speaking of the Melchizedek, thank you, of various... in all kinds of circumstances. For instance, you know, we think about their having functioned here because we literally had the rare occasion of a Melchizedek incarnating on our world, only the seventh time in Nebadon, which has over 3.8 million worlds. You know, only the seventh mm-hmm. time that was done. So a rare kind of a thing, but because of that, we tend to think of And we know that they were Melchizedek receivers for our planet, and they've had a lot to do with our world. We're told about the Melchizedek University surrounding Salvington, the 490 worlds. And we're also told that they are very educationally involved in other areas. All of that is ascendant related. What we're not told, their latitude of function that even likely functions in ministering to other orders of beings that have nothing to do with the ascendant mortal regime.
And I think that's
also an interesting aspect of things. The same is true of the Verondadex. You know, they're rulers of the constellation level, which is the legislative level. And when they're functioning at that level, they, they're really functioning, we're told, really more concerned about group function. They really don't pay attention to individuals in the same way that, say, either the Lenonidex might in some cases and the Melchizedek might in other cases. We know that Maceventa, while he was incarnated, paid close attention to particularly Abraham, but many others that went through the Salem schools as he prepared them to go out as missionaries throughout the world, to the West, as far as Britain. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So all of that was
very
remarkable.
Personal. I mean, his engagement, that's a good point.
Yes.
You know, like they talk about that family that he stayed with for 30 years. I mean, that was very personal, actually living with his family, you know. And
that's literally getting a familial experience. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well,
if he wouldn't have been regarded as a member of the family by that point, you know, you can imagine him really having a very similar kind of experience to what Jesus of Nazareth had, you know, growing up in his Nazareth family and then raising his brothers and sisters. And even though he left for periods during that, he came back and worked at the shop until his baptism at about 31 and a half years of age. And so it's very interesting, the parallels there, that there would have been that kind of experience of growing up and experiencing a full generation of individuals experiencing his brothers and sisters getting married.
With Jesus,
and
especially.
Having kids,
And I think it's interesting, too, with Maceventa, that, you know, he didn't go through all of that. He just appeared one day, right? They made a body for him that he lived in, what, for 95 years or something? Or 195 years, I think. Anyway, but the point is... That he must have had a very friendly nature. I mean, here he is, this high, I mean, local universe, but high local universe, son of God. And yet here he is, you know, perfectly comfortable and friendly with the mortals on this world. To me, that says a lot about the nature of God, that the divinity kind of works that way. It's friendly, you know, it's engaging, it's endearing. I mean, I'm trying to picture what that household must have looked like back then, you know, sitting down to dinner. But there's nothing intimidating there. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah.
There's something delightful, in other words, when I think about that. And, well, it's just the way he entered the tent, you know, of Amnon. You know, here I am. Look out. I don't know.
While he was building up the Salem schools and all of that, what were the mundane tasks that he might have been involved in?
Hard to know. But the people liked him, other words, is what I'm trying to say. You know, and he never had to worry about, you know, all these armies going back and forth. You know, they all left him alone, which is also interesting, I think. I mean, Abraham, you know, had something to do with that. But anyway, well, we can dive into this.
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. You want to start us off?
You Yeah, sure. Now, we want to start off with the Lunanodek rulers. Is that what you wanted to do?
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Okay.
Unless there's anything you want to point
even
out.
Even if you covered
the previous
it,
section.
Might have only just covered it right just briefly. So, yeah, okay.
Yeah, we might have read it quickly with the intention to go back over it. So,
okay.
Let's do that.
I'll be glad to read it.
All right, cool.
Sure.
Excellent. Thanks.
Section 9, the Lunanodek rulers. The Lunanodeks are the continuous rulers of the planets and the rotating sovereigns of the systems. Such a sun now rules on Jerusalem, the headquarters of your local system of inhabited worlds. The system sovereigns rule in commissions of two or three on the headquarters of each system of inhabited worlds. The Constellation Father names one of these Lunanodeks as chief every decamillennium. Sometimes no change in the head of the trio is made, the matter being entirely optional with the constellation rulers. System governments do not suddenly change in personnel unless a tragedy of some sort occurs. When system sovereigns or assistants are recalled, their places are filled by selections made by the Supreme Council located on the constellation headquarters from the reserves of that order, a group which is larger on Edentia than the average indicated. The Supreme Lunanodek Councils are stationed on the various constellation headquarters. Such a body is presided over by the senior most high associate of the Constellation Father, while the junior associates supervise the reserves of the secondary order. Supervisors. The system sovereigns are true to their names. They are well-nigh sovereign in the local affairs of the inhabited worlds. They are almost paternal in their direction of the planetary princes, the material suns, and the ministering spirits. The personal grasp of the sovereign is all but complete. These rulers are not supervised by Trinity observers from the central universe. They are the executive division of the local universe, and as custodians of the enforcement of legislative mandates and as executives for the application of judicial verdicts, they present the one place in all universe administration where personal disloyalty to the will of the Michael Sun could most easily and readily entrench itself and seek to assert itself. Our local universe has been unfortunate in that over 700 sons of the Lunanodek order have rebelled against the universe government, thus precipitating confusion in several systems and on numerous planets. Of this entire number of failures, only three were system sovereigns. Practically all of these sons belonged to the second and third orders, planetary princes, and tertiary Lunanodeks. The large number of these sons who have lapsed from integrity does not indicate any fault in creatorship. They could have been made divinely perfect, but they were so created that they might better understand and draw near to the evolutionary creatures dwelling on the worlds of time and space. Of all the local universes in Orbontan, our universe has, with the exception of Hensalon, the largest number of this order of suns. On Universa, it is the consensus that we have had so much administrative trouble in Nebadon because our sons of the Lunanodek order have been created with such a large degree of personal liberty in choosing and planning. I do not make this observation by way of criticism. The creator of our universe has full authority and power to do this. It is the contention of our high rulers that while such free choosing sons make excessive trouble in the earlier ages of the universe, when things are fully sifted and finally settled, the gains of higher loyalty and fuller volitional service on the part of these thoroughly tested sons will far more than compensate for the confusion and tribulations of earlier times. In the event of rebellion on a system headquarters, a new sovereign is usually installed within a comparatively short time, but not so on the individual planets. They are the component units of the material creation, and creature free will is a factor in the final adjudication of all such problems. Successor planetary princes are designated for isolated worlds. Planets whose princes of authority may have gone astray, but they do not assume active rulership of such worlds until the results of insurrection are partially overcome and removed by the remedial measures adopted by the Melchizedeks and other ministering personalities. Rebellion by a planetary prince instantly isolates his planet. The local spiritual circuits are immediately severed. Only a bestowal son can reestablish interplanetary lines of communication on such a spiritually isolated world. There exists a plan for saving these wayward and unwise sons, and many have availed themselves of this merciful provision. But never again may they function in those positions wherein they defaulted. After rehabilitation, they are assigned to custodial duties and to departments of physical administration.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot in there.
And just dealing with the numbers aspect, I like to point out that from where they begin talking about it in Section 8, and they speak of the idea that there are, you know, exactly, they started out with exactly 12 million Lenonadecs. And then they indicate here that over 700 have been lost, or have, sorry, not have been lost, have gone into default or rebellion. Do they indicate they all went into rebellion? Just trying to remember how I read that.
Yeah, right. Then some changed their ways, I think. Let's see, where was that number?
They have rebelled. They actually say have rebelled. So.
Yeah, right, right. Mm-hmm.
So given that you know, over 700 have rebelled, like just taking in round numbers, just taking 1,000 out of 12 million, you know, 1,000 and a million would be 1%, 10% of 1%. In 12 million, it's less than 1% of 1%. And 700 is an even smaller number, an even smaller fraction of 1% of 1%. So that's significant to indicate that less than 1 in 10,000 rebel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a pretty good track record for creating these beings with as much latitude of liberty as they're created with. I think that's one of the most important things to realize, that we're close to rebellion, so we're experiencing the dire consequences of that. But most places don't experience this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's what makes our experience so unusual and even valuable in some ways. Going forward, you know, the whole egg and donor idea and all of that. So, I don't know. I think we should, you know, I've never felt an inclination to complain about being on a rebellion world. I mean, what an opportunity it is. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of downsides to it, but still.
We don't know any different anyway.
And observe, to observe. It's really extraordinary. Yeah. But what do you think about this, what they're saying about the Lenonadecs in our local universe, having been created with a larger, what do they call it, degree of personal liberty in choosing and planning? When they put it that way, it sounds like it's part of their nature. I mean, it's not an external restraint. it doesn't seem. It's
right.
Something different in their nature that enables that greater range of action and decision making.
Yeah.
Greater range of personal liberty. It's so fascinating to think of how that could be more or less a part of someone's nature. And it, you know, makes me think of what it's like being human, you know, because we have our own range of personal liberty or degree of personal liberty in choosing and planning that feels pretty unrestricted. I mean, it's restricted externally by circumstances and opportunities and whatever. But internally, it seems like it's more a matter of our own grasping the issues and learning and growing and developing into our potential. But I don't feel like there's a low ceiling on what that potential is, you know, for us, even
right.
as humans. So I wonder if there's some parallel there. I mean, I don't know how there could be exactly. I mean, we're not exact aren't creators, so. But still, maybe coming from Michael, you know, it's like he wants from the non-index to be more like him. I mean, not in a literal sense, but with a range of action that has this, what eventually becomes, you know, the gains of higher loyalty and fuller volitional service. See, that's the part that I think is so fascinating about that. Fuller volitional service. It's like they're able to choose within a greater range somehow. Fuller volitional service. I mean, that's like voluntary. They have a higher loyalty, which enables them to almost like volunteer in a fuller way that's more like the Spirit of God. You know, the generosity of the Spirit of God, maybe something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, I agree with you.
Yeah.
There's something that's been created in them. What occurs to me is the idea that, this quote that we would have read a number of weeks back when we were studying the Creative Mother Spirit,
mm-hmm.
Paper 34, 3 and 8, they make an interesting statement about the Creative Mother Spirit, but they then make a more general statement about will and freedom and consciousness, and that is
go ahead, 34:3,
paragraph 8. Yes. When a creative spirit becomes space conscious, she is preparing to recognize a circumscribed space domain as hers, a realm in which to be space free in contradistinction to all other space in which she would be conditioned. One is free to choose and act only within the realm of one's consciousness. So the implication for me here is that the Lanonadec sons are created with a broader range of consciousness. They can be aware of much more in which to be able to act.
That's
what
great.
Do you think about that?
I think that's great. I think that really helps. I mean, that comment about one is free to choose and act only within the realm of one's consciousness, I mean, that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
And that's certainly true in our case. And I could see how that might be where the calibration is made, you might say, on Michael's part. And determining and, you know, with the Mother Spirit, settling on their design, you might say, for the Lanonadecs in their universe. And there's got to be sort of a calibration point in there somewhere, and it probably has to do with what you're saying. The range of their consciousness can maybe be attenuated or expanded somehow in their creation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of
right, exactly.
You know, fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, they can be creative to be able to be in-circuited to greater or lesser extent. That indicates something almost very technical in what the creator son and the creative spirits are thinking about in projecting their creation. The same thing would be true, mm-hmm. for instance, with the Veranda decks, although it would be maybe harder for them to get across to us what kinds of things they would be including or excluding in the consciousness of various Veranda decks. They indicate, for instance, that the numbers in the various local universes of Veranda deck sons are very different. There can be many more, for instance, than we have in Nebadon. And we only have, I think, about 1 million, much less than either the Melchizedek sons, of which there are about 10 million, and we're not told the exact number there, and mm-hmm. the Lenonadec order, of which there were exactly 12 million. And now, presumably, there are fewer by some number than 12 million. We're not told how many.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all very interesting.
Yeah.
It gives us insight into what can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what they're indicating by talking about Hensalon, they're probably encouraging us to make an assumption here that, well, why would Hensalon have more rebellion or more Lenonadex that have gone into rebellion than Nebadon, since they're indicating that that's the one exception.
Yeah,
and that would
yeah.
imply
yeah.
that creator son has created those Lenonadex with even greater liberty at choosing and planning.
Yeah, they're
perhaps
living on the edge over at Hensalon.
Right.
I don't know.
Not that the creator sons are in competition with one another saying,
right.
Oh, yeah, you think that's liberty?
Yeah.
I doubt that that's the case. But, yeah.
Man. But to go along with what you're saying about the differences in these beings, this is a little interesting comment from the previous section about Veranadex, 35.5.3, says they do not equal mm-hmm. their Melchizedek brethren in brilliant versatility, but they are even more reliable and efficient as rulers and far-seeing administrators. So again, it's like there's a focusing of the capacities and abilities of these created sons, these created orders of sonship, that seems to be in the hands of Michael and the Mother Spirit in their design for them. So this would just be another example of a description about how the Melchizedeks are different from the Veranadeks. And that's clearly by design. So
yes,
their
yes,
grasp,
exactly.
Their creative grasp of these potentials, when you're talking about creating, you know, orders of sonship, you know, with first source personality, it's pretty remarkable. Of course, they are. They
yeah.
come from paradise. I mean, Michael and the Mother Spirit, they're paradise origin. So, but even so,
yeah,
fascinating to think how they can kind of shape the nature of a being in its creation to fulfill certain, you know, needs within the affairs of a local universe. And it's so kind of symmetrical and beautiful, as you know, as we learn about these different orders of being, how they fit into, you know, a matrix of necessity and possibility.
Right.
You know, just the complemental nature
and
of
these,
some of them, or it's yeah.
And
so
it,
like these
what's interesting about it is we're just being told about those orders that have to do with our ascension, you know, that we will
mm-hmm.
come in contact with, that will be part of our progression. We're not really told, you know, about all the other orders that are doing important work in the local universe
mm-hmm.
that
oh, yeah.
has nothing to do with the ascension regime, but are
uh-huh.
equally important to the economy of the local universe.
Yeah, they hint at that somewhere. All these other purposes of the universe, you know.
Yes.
They're not even going to try to tell us about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
kind of crazy to think about. But
interesting.
I guess
Gary
yeah.
on the board is yeah. saying, it's so interesting. The further we are from perfection, the more opportunity there is to stretch the potential of the supreme age. You know, this evolutionary finite age that we're in, this
mm-hmm.
second age.
Mm-hmm.
The perfect God benefits from, indeed needs, decoupling from perfection by those with evolutionary experiential free will. Indeed, the completion of any phase of a universe age needs all expressive potential, even the potential for sin expression. Lanonadex are interesting due to their relatively wide influence and high degree of latitude of individual expression. And lastly, the finite age needs Agendaunters, and rebellions create billions of us. Well, so now it's an interesting question philosophically.
Mm.
And Pam is concurring on the board. By the way, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Dee. Good morning, Pam. Mm. Gary, Isadora, wonderful to see you here. Kim was on for a little while. Good to have you, and good to have you, Vaughn, tuning in.
Hey, yeah, welcome
and,
everyone.
And hello to all of you who will tune in on the archive later. What's interesting here is, you know, there is this importance of having people that have withstood rebellion and can be trusted in certain positions, presumably because there's, I don't know, temptation or there's a need for resiliency, you name it. It's hard to imagine how these higher pursuits require these things unless you had so much freedom that you could do real damage were you not functioning within your own self-restraint. And that's a very important thing that's being stated here. My question always with this is, would God be somehow disappointed if there was no rebellion? I mean, I can't imagine that would be the case, but it's a taking into account of its possibility, its likelihood, maybe even its inevitability, given how the creation is being set up as an evolutionary creation. It's a really interesting philosophical question, because God could not possibly desire that people, individuals, go into rebellion and effectively kill themselves. That would not be within the nature of God. On the other hand, what is it in the attitude, say, of the Trinity to think in terms of judgment and mercy and all the different factors that the Trinity would be thinking about with regard to the group? It's a very interesting idea to suppose that things were created with this as a possibility, even though it was not a desired possibility. Pam
right.
further elaborates
well, it
says
along.
Rebellion
yeah.
tested suggests being able to see better in the dark, which is a great way to put it, Pam. That's super.
No,
yeah.
it's pocket. You got your flashlight in.
right.
Right. Well, I was just going to say that, you know, a lot of this comes out of the risky gift of free will, you know, that we receive from the Father, regardless of our station in the universe. And that includes Lanonadex as well as us, angels and a lot of other kinds of beings. So having this gift of free will, where we have autonomy, in a sense, you know, we've been given a little piece of sovereignty that we manage as best we can. That's, you know, what do they say? It entails inevitable tragedy. And that's
right.
why, you know, the Father declares that he'll always be with us, you know, to help us through it if we can make it. So the occurrence of rebellion, you know, how that originates is maybe kind of part of the question, because don't they say with Lucifer that it originated within his own mind or something like that? They could sort of see that something was going off in his thinking. You know, he's maybe reflecting, looking in the mirror too much at his own beauty or something. You know, and he ended up
self-deifying. They definitely do.
Essentially.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of going off the rails that way is within this latitude, you know, that they speak of here in the creation of the Lunanodex in our local universe, that they have that, you know. But I can see how either resisting that or not going that way or bringing those same potentials to a positive purpose would be a wonderful thing. And ability to minister effectively to lower orders, like mortals in particular, could benefit from overcoming those kind of, I don't know, we'd call it temptation in the case of a Lunanodex. But something happened in Lucifer's mind. And
right. You know, that's in 53:2:2. I don't know if you want me to read it or if you'd prefer to read it. There were no peculiar, 53:2:2, there were no peculiar or special conditions in the system of Satania which suggested or favored rebellion. It is our belief that the idea took origin and form in Lucifer's mind, and that he might have instigated such a rebellion no matter where he might have been stationed. Lucifer first announced his plans to Satan, but it required several months to corrupt the mind of this able and brilliant associate. However, once converted to the rebel theories, he became a bold and earnest advocate of self-assertion and liberty. The other thing that they indicate was that the Lunan or the Lunanodex, the Most Highs, and this indicates something about their ability and how much higher they must be, because they took note that all was not well maybe 100 years before, and I think they meant 100 standard years, that all was not well.
Yeah, they say that in the next paragraph.
Lucifer's mind.
100 years of standard
time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now this is the Union of Days on Salvington, because we were just reading.
Oh, is that who saw it?
Yeah, it says, notwithstanding his silence, not interesting. Like, he's like, okay, you guys, I'm just we're seeing this. It says, well, and this is just in the middle of the next paragraph, that's the one you read. It says, at no time prior to the exaltation of his own mind did Lucifer openly express dissatisfaction about the universe administration. Notwithstanding his silence, for more than 100 years of standard time, the Union of Days on Salvington had been reflectivating to Uversa that all was not at peace in Lucifer's mind. This information was also communicated to the Creator Son and the Constellation Fathers of Nor-Lashadec.
Yeah. That's in exactly
this period,
the following paragraph. Yeah.
What's that?
That's in exactly the following paragraph from the one that I read. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So they could see that something was up. You know, that now that the Union of Days on Salvington. Union of Days is paradise order, right?
That's correct.
That's paradise. The paradise representation on that's like a manual, right?
That is a manual. Yeah.
Right.
There's only one.
So there's
on each local universe.
Right. So in the previous paragraph, the section that we're actually reading, they point out that there are no these system rulers are not supervised by Trinity observers from the central universe. So this Union of Days would be an example of that, but it doesn't apparently reach below.
Right.
The level.
Yeah, what they're alluding to there is that the faithfuls of days are one on each constellation. So there's 100 faithfuls of days on each of the constellation headquarters, and they are counselors to the Virandadec sons, to the Most High.
Right, exactly.
And what they're indicating is that there is, there's no, you know, what would they call them anyway? You know, but there is no...
Well, Trinity observers in this one case, counselors.
Yeah, right. They're of the order of days, and they indicate essentially that there is no order of days that would be assigned to the local systems. And maybe they don't for a variety of reasons. That they are not interested in hampering the function of these executives who really have to get, quote unquote, down and dirty into, you know, the material realms and have to make some, you know, plenty of decisions with regard to how they're going to administer executively these particular realms. That's just speculative.
Right. Well, that might be part of it, yeah. And plus, there are a lot of local systems, way more than these higher levels of administration. So
yeah,
that would
have
be
to
a
have
quantity.
Times
of,
more. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not that they couldn't do that, but they choose not to.
I mean, they could. Yeah. They choose not to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that...
well, anything else that strikes you
comment,
in this section?
Yeah. I want to just... In that same paragraph, 35.9.5, where they say that these rulers are not supervised by Trinity observers in the central universe, they go on to say something else that I think is kind of interesting. They say of these Monadic system sovereigns, I think, they are the executive division of the local universe, and as custodians of the enforcement of legislative mandates and as executives for the application of judicial verdicts, they present the one place in all universe administration where personal disloyalty to the will of the Michelson could most easily and readily entrench itself and seek to assert itself. I just think it's interesting that they associate those two things in that way, that kind of responsibility opens the door to, you know, I don't know what exactly, monkey business or something. You know, I don't usually think of the system sovereigns in this way, you know, that's part of their responsibility, enforcement of legislative mandates and executives for the application of judicial verdicts. That's a kind of responsibility where you're tied to what others are doing. You know, enforcement of legislation that's been passed by others, or you're executing you're executing the or applying, you know, a judicial verdict that's done by someone else, right? So they have that kind of engagement where they're responsible for executing what other people have done. They're not just, you know, full of themselves.
Well, we've seen that.
Well, sometimes they become that way, but you know what I mean? I mean, maybe it's like, too much paperwork, you know? It's like, I just want to be king of the mountain or something. I don't know. You have to wonder what they mean when they say this is the one place where personal disloyalty to Michael can most easily. I mean, I'm just being funny, but there's something to that. You know, it's like Lucifer had all these, you know, higher ambitions that they say he would have had if he just hung in. You know, all the kind of power and influence and authority and prestige they apparently wanted, he could have had and would have had. Naturally, if he'd remained loyal.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to overstep that. So.
Well, just giving you an example, you know, in our own culture, we clearly have had plenty of examples in recent times of all kinds of things that have occurred where one branch of government has disagreed with another branch of government and has decided, for instance, not to enforce a law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, selective enforcement is a kind of disloyalty to a higher concept.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So, just like so many things on this world, you know, see the echoes and effects of the Lucifer Rebellion and the Lucifer Manifesto just kind of running through things. You know, and it just pops up and you go, oh, I know where that came from. Most people don't have that, you know, it's hard to have that kind of understanding that this is actually we're downstream from something that was done deliberately. And
yeah.
It's affecting us even today in all these little ways, some of which are not so little, but they all have to do with this self-will kind of taking precedence over voluntary responsibility for the good of the whole, or however you want to put that. Yeah, you know,
say it again. Precedence.
Battle going on between self-interest and.
I missed the word you used. Precedence? Did you say or what? What did you say?
Oh yeah. Where self-interest takes priority, let's say, over the good of the group or the good of the whole.
Right.
And it seems like there's always battle going on between self-interest and selfless, more of a selfless volunteering spirit where you want to see good outcome for everybody, right? And that intense kind of self-will approach to things is, you know, comes straight out of the Lucifer Manifesto. That's what Lucifer was preaching. So,
right.
I don't know. I mean, it makes all of this kind of relevant, you might say, to day-to-day life as we experience it now. It's like we're still...
Sure.
And, of course, then we still have our favorite rebel beings on the planet with us, which doesn't help. But.
Well, it's one of the most relevant things that we have to speak about. And in that context, let me just reiterate something that Pam has put on the board. She said, it's interesting that Michael did not act upon the Union of Days observation. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yeah. Huh.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, it suggests
a
great latitude.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Or it suggests a great latitude, or maybe Pam meant to say the great value in creating this great latitude of free will. And part of Michael's mercy-dominated inheritance, this idea of let's see how things play out. Let's see how this will that we have lovingly bestowed, or that the Father has lovingly bestowed because we've created the life circumstance for this to occur, let's see how it plays out. It seems to be all playing out on the stage of the Supreme. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they point out in that same section we were looking at a minute ago in paper 53 that he was long offered opportunity for repentance. So it's not as if they didn't try to pull him back from the brink.
Right.
So.
Well, he didn't think he was on the brink. He thought he was on.
Yeah, right.
He was, you know, he was on a new frontier. One person's
frontier
can be another person's brink.
Uh-huh.
That's actually instructive to think about.
Yeah.
And the door on the board says, and unique to his personality, you know, that not only is it Michael's mercy-dominated inheritance, but unique to the personality he was given as well. So we're told that Michaels are unique both in nature and personality. And
the Michaels are too.
So what's happening here is original. It's not going to happen the same way in any other local universe. There may be rebellions, but they're going to happen differently. And again, much less frequently, frankly, the indication would be that it would be highly unusual. There may be only one other local universe that has had more system rebellions than we have had in Orvontan. Or it may be that with fewer Lenonidex rebelling in some local universe, that there were more somehow system sovereigns that rebelled. But that would be highly unusual. But you can then say in a universe where there are at least 83,000, if not 87,000, creator suns with local universes up and running, right? If you can say that in that range, the outliers too, and that everything else is less, then you can imagine local universes on the other end of the extreme, possibly some of the earlier ones. We don't know how the creator suns have been assigned, but perhaps for stability's sake, these creator suns having Lenonidex with, you know, more constricted latitude of decision, that there could be local universes where system rebellions and even planetary rebellions never happened. Just never happened.
That's conceivable. Even with that, or even on normal worlds in our system, there's still, at least they talk about this, there's still potential evil. There's still actual evil and potential evil, even on non-rebellion worlds. And we don't really know the full range of that either. I mean, Jesus talks about it a little bit, but just the evolutionary circumstances give rise to, you know, all kinds of problems that have to be overcome. So it doesn't necessarily mean that life is a picnic on the normal evolutionary world, at least in their earlier stages. But what they don't have to deal with is that sort of evil being done deliberately, you know, as a kind of a strategy of rebellion against God. That doesn't happen. But you still have to contend with a lot of evolutionary evil. Well, and they even say that the Lenonidex sometimes have to seize the governments, even of non-rebellion worlds. I don't quite know what would bring that about, but it just kind of suggests that things can get kind of gnarly, even on normal worlds sometimes, which wouldn't surprise me.
I'm sure that it happens.
It's all interesting, but
that you have rogue countries and that kind of thing occurring. You know,
just the natural evolutionary competition, land for land, everything. Yeah, that's all just evolutionary. That's not rebellion in the Urantia book sense. but
let me take a moment to just station identify. Yeah. You're listening to the Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. We're studying the Local Universe Sons of God, paper 35. And this is part 6, the final section. We're dealing with sections 9 and 10 in that paper 35, talking about the Lenonidex rulers. And then finally, section 10 is coming up. You know, we might why don't we take a reading break and we can come back and discuss anything else we want to yet in this paper before we transition to our next study.
All right.
Would you like to read that?
Before we do that, I had one last thought about the mind of these Lenonidex. I mean, just again, going back to that same section 53, but there's a really interesting comment in the last paragraph where they say that, difficult to point out the exact cause or causes, which, you know, finally culminated in the Lucifer Rebellion. But then they say, we're certain of only one thing, and that is, whatever these first beginnings were, they had their origin in Lucifer's mind. Okay, we read that. But then they say, there must have been a pride of self that nourished itself to the point of self-deception, so that Lucifer for a time really persuaded himself that his contemplation of rebellion was actually for the good of the system, if not for the universe. So that capacity for self-deception is part of the package, kind of, I guess, of this greater latitude or greater range of choice that non-objects have.
And I'd even in this universe, you know, yeah, Pam is making the point self-assertion could be part of that. And what you indicated earlier, self-interest, as opposed to the interest for the wider good, can also be part of that.
Right.
I mean, isn't it insidious how many times rulers throughout the world and throughout history, you know, have in the name of their own self-interest rationalized that this would be for the good of the people, quote unquote, right? That they would.
That happens.
I mean,
yeah.
You look
and
at
sometimes they don't
know,
even
Hitler.
Bother with the cover. Just, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, this capacity for self-deception is something that we share, of course.
Yeah.
And that's something, you know, we always have to be on the lookout for. And it's hard sometimes because sometimes we don't want to see certain things. We don't want to believe certain things about ourselves. And that's why it's so important that we have the spirit within us to keep our heads above water when it comes to those kind of situations. But anyway, I just thought that piece about self-deception was interesting in the context of what we were talking about their latitude of will. Anyway.
Yes.
Let's go ahead. So section 10.
Section 10, the Lunanudec worlds.
All right, the Lunanudec worlds. The third group of seven worlds in the Salvington circuit of 70 planets with their respective 42 satellites constitute the Lunanudec cluster of administrative spheres. Of these realms, the experienced Lunanudecs belonging to the X system sovereign core officiate as administrative teachers of the ascending pilgrims and the seraphic hosts. The evolutionary mortals observe the system administrators at work on the system capitals. Evolutionary mortals observe the system administrators at work on the system capitals. But here they participate in the actual coordination of the administrative pronouncements of the 10,000 local systems. These administrative schools of the local universe are supervised by a core of Lunanudec sons who have had long experience as system sovereigns and as constellation counselors. These executive colleges are excelled only by the administrative schools of ENSA. So remind everyone where ENSA is.
Sure. ENSA is our sector.
Minor sector, right, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So that includes our local universe and 99 others, potentially.
Right.
Assuming that not all the rest of the 99 have yet come into being.
Mm-hmm. So that's the next
probably
level.
About 83 or 84 of them have been started by their respective creator sons. Ours being one of the most recent.
So these executive colleges they're talking about are excelled only by the schools of ENSA. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and
we might remind people
as well that on the minor sector, this is where we graduate, you know, on Salvington, our last Marantra phase is followed by a transition to first stage spirit status on Salvington prior to are leaving the local universe for ENSA. And on ENSA, the primary study on U minor the third and its seven satellites, which are probably enormous. I mean, each satellite is probably as big as Salvington. So that'll be interesting. But that particular stage of administration is largely involved in administering, you know, coordinating the local universes, but particularly physical and energy coordination. So that will be very interesting to note how are things handled at that level, and where we're studying not only that kind of administration, but also studying pure energy and matter for the first time.
Yeah. Just how things are put together from that level of perspective. Yeah, that's going to be something. Yeah. Okay, well, then, thanks for that. Let me keep reading. While serving as training spheres for ascending mortals, the Lunanadec worlds are the centers for extensive undertakings having to do with the normal and routine administrative operations of the universe. All the way into paradise, the ascending pilgrims pursue their studies in the practical schools of applied knowledge, actual training, and really doing the things they are being taught. Wow, what a concept. The universe educational system, sponsored by the Melchizedeks, progressive, meaningful, and experiential. It embraces training in things material, intellectual, moral, and spiritual. Matter, mind, and spirit. It is in connection with these administrative spheres of the Lunanadec that most of the salvaged sons of that order serve as custodians and directors of planetary affairs. And these defaulting planetary princes and their associates in rebellion who choose to accept the proffered rehabilitation will continue to serve in these routine capacities, at least until the universe of Nebadon is settled in light and life. Many of the Lunanadec sons in the older systems, however, have established wonderful records of service, administration, and spiritual achievement. They are a noble, faithful, and loyal group, notwithstanding their tendencies to fall into error through fallacies of personal liberty and fictions of self-determination. Sponsored by Chief of Archangels, acting by authority of Gabriel of Salvation. Huh. Wow, that's an
I've always looked at the Archangels as the tell it like it is authors. They're the ones who often say, you know, especially like in the Celestial Artisans paper, you know, but you could never conceive
this.
You can hardly imagine what this would be like, you know.
You're right. Right. Don't even forget it.
And so he's telling it like it is here. Interesting, though, that this is by the Chief of Archangels. I mean, that's like having, you know, the president of a country, you know, write a paper.
So that would be Chief of Archangels of Nebadon, right?
Of Nebadon, yeah. And that's a group of about 800.
Right?
Yeah, they are. And there's about 800,000 of them.
You know, we have that, but what do they call it? A receiving station or something? Archangel Divisional Headquarters.
Yes, the Archangel Circuit, the Divisional Headquarters.
On this planet.
And the Archangel Circuit. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's apparently an extraordinary thing from perspective of student visitors and, you know, universe travelers. And we don't, of course, really know what that means, but someday we'll find out, I'm sure. But they say that it does compensate for the being isolated by quarantine in some ways. So that's cool. But this last sentence, they're a noble, faithful, and loyal group, notwithstanding their tendency to fall into error. Okay, these are the two sources of error, apparently. Fallacies of personal liberty and fictions of self-determination.
Sorry, I lost connection there for a moment.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm just pointing out that last sentence in the section, which I think is pretty telling, where this Chief of Archangels comments that these Lunanadec are a noble, faithful, and loyal group, notwithstanding their tendency to fall into error, the fallacies of personal liberty and fictions of self-determination. So those two tendencies are what apparently caused them to fall into error. So they fall into error through fallacies of personal liberty and fictions of self-determination. So those two, that fallacy and that fiction, are, you know, something we all have to contend with, I think, and, you know, just living a life on this planet. You know, okay, do I go this path or do I go that path? And those two things are always two of the options that we have, because they've been taught on this planet, you know, in such a pervasive way that it's easy to just, you know, I don't know, do what thou wilt, you know, the fallacy of personal liberty, where it's unbridled, it's unrestrained, I think is what they're talking about. And then fictions of self-determination. I wonder if you have a thought on what they mean by that. I mean, there is self-determination to some extent. I mean, we all, you know, that's our responsibility in a way, is to determine our path. You know, we try and do that in partnership with God, but we still have to do it. You know, so that's, we have the will, so we have to carry out the plans that we make, and hopefully, you know, in coordination with the divine spirit. But in a way, that is a kind of self-determination. So I wonder what they mean by fictions of self-determination. It'd be like false liberty, I guess, in some sense. I don't know. Do you have any thought on that? Did I lose you?
You haven't lost me. Just a minute.
Oh, okay. No worries. Yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense of when self-determination, where the transition point is from it being a fiction to being a responsibility, and how we can maybe have a better understanding of legitimate self-determination, which probably is the source of true personal liberty as opposed to fallacious personal liberty. Are you there, Andre?
I am. I apologize.
Oh, there you are. No worries.
Life is intruding.
Life is a bean. Okay.
I had a repairman come to the door, and we'll need to try to take care of that. But let's do this. What you were saying in a nutshell was, I was trying to follow along. I've been with one ear on you and one ear on the repairman for a moment.
Sure. Trying for a better understanding of what they mean by fictions of self-determination.
Yes.
Well, because we do kind of have the responsibility to determine our path and so forth. So there's, I think, a legitimate range of self-determination. But where's the boundary where it crosses over into a fiction of self? I guess when it's outside the will of God, maybe.
Yeah. You know, I think this would be an interesting place. We could do a little departure, and just considering what I'm needing to deal with on the outside with a repairman just briefly, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be a good idea for us to go to paper 54 and do a brief side study on these fictions of self-determination.
Could you read true and false liberty?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I can
discuss that.
Read that while you're doing your thing there.
Yeah. I'll try to take care of that. I'm trying to give a repairman access to something. Apologies.
Got it. No worries.
He's here early.
Okay. All right. He's always there early. I hate that.
Which is better than not showing up at all.
sure, always true. So I think I'll start actually pick up these two opening paragraphs because they kind of set the context for this. And here's where this is the book talking about the problems of the Lucifer Rebellion in paper 54. And they say, evolutionary man finds it difficult fully to comprehend the significance, to grasp the meanings of evil, error, sin, and iniquity. Man is slow to perceive that contrastive perfection and imperfection produce potential evil, that conflicting truth and falsehood create confusing error, that the divine endowment of free will, choice, eventuates in the divergent realms of sin and righteousness, that the persistent pursuit of divinity leads to the kingdom of God, is contrasted with its continuous rejection, which leads to the domains of iniquity. The gods neither create evil nor permit sin and rebellion. Yeah, so that's important. Kind of maybe goes back to Andre's question earlier a little bit in some way. So the gods never create evil nor permit sin and rebellion. Potential evil is time existent in a universe embracing differential levels of perfection meanings and values. Sin is potential in all realms where imperfect beings are endowed with the ability to choose between good and evil. The very conflicting presence of truth and untruth, facts and falsehood, constitutes the potentiality of error. The deliberate choice of evil constitutes sin. The willful rejection of truth is error. The persistent pursuit of sin and error is iniquity. So interesting in this discussion how they're throwing in error as one of this sort of group of possibilities. Okay, so this is sort of, we're getting into the relevant part in terms of these Lenonidexons. So this is section one, same paper, true and false liberty. Of all the perplexing problems growing out of the Lucifer Rebellion, none has occasioned more difficulty than the failure of immature evolutionary mortals to distinguish between true and false liberty. Excuse me, I'm just going to take a quick drink of water. So yeah, that hits the nail on the head. That's what we all experience and see all the time. It's this difficulty distinguishing between true and false liberty. So they go on to say, true liberty is the quest of the ages and the reward of evolutionary progress. False liberty is the subtle deception of the error of time and the evil of space. Enduring liberty is predicated on the reality of justice, intelligence, maturity, fraternity, and equity. Liberty is the self-destroying technique of cosmic existence. Wow, what a way to put that. Liberty is the self-destroying technique of cosmic existence when its motivation is unintelligent, unconditioned, and uncontrolled. True liberty is progressively related to reality and is ever regardful of social equity, cosmic fairness, universe fraternity, and divine obligations. Liberty is suicidal when divorced from material justice, intellectual fairness, social forbearance, moral duty, and spiritual values. Liberty is non-existent apart from cosmic reality, and all personality reality is proportional to its divinity relationships. That's interesting. All personality reality is proportional to its divinity relationships. So if you stray from divinity, your personality is heading off into unreality. Unbridled self-will and unregulated self-expression equal unmitigated selfishness, the acme of ungodliness. Liberty, without the associated and ever-increasing conquest of self, is a figment of egoistic mortal imagination. Motivated liberty is a conceptual illusion, a cruel deception. License, masquerading in the garments of liberty, is the forerunner of abject bondage. Well, sobering stuff here. Wise words, though. True liberty is the associate of genuine self-respect. False liberty is the consort of self-admiration. True liberty is the fruit of self-control. False liberty, the assumption of self-assertion. Self-control leads to altruistic service. Admiration tends towards the exploitation of others for the selfish aggrandizement of such a mistaken individual as is willing to sacrifice righteous attainment for the sake of possessing unjust power over his fellow beings. Even wisdom is divine and safe only when it is cosmic in scope and spiritual in motivation. There is no error greater than that species of self-deception which leads intelligent beings to crave the exercise of power over other beings for the purpose of depriving these persons of their natural liberties. Interesting how they refer to that as a species of self-deception. It may involve deceiving others, but you're deceiving yourself first, I think. Anyway, it goes on. The golden rule of human fairness cries out against all such fraud, unfairness, selfishness, and unrighteousness. Only true and genuine liberty is compatible with the reign of love and the ministry of mercy. How dare the self-willed creature encroach upon the rights of his fellows in the name of personal liberty when the supreme rulers of the universe stand back in merciful respect for these prerogatives of will and potentials of personality? No being, in the exercise of his supposed personal liberty, has a right to deprive any other being of those privileges of existence conferred by the creators and duly respected by all their loyal associates, subordinates, and subjects. Evolutionary man may have to contend for his material liberties, tyrants and oppressors on a world of sin and iniquity, for during the early times of a primitive evolving sphere. But not so on the Marantia worlds or on the spirit spheres. War is the heritage of early evolutionary man. But on worlds of normal advancing civilization, physical combat as a technique for adjusting racial misunderstandings has long since fallen into disrepute. However they put that. Oh, war, that fell into disrepute a while ago.
Yeah.
You know, we don't entertain that idea anymore.
Right.
Are you back?
I'm sort of back,
Andre.
Yeah. I
sort
apologize.
Of back, okay.
You know, the serviceman was supposed to arrive afternoon, and he's arrived
mm-hmm.
early and can't get access to the roof, so we're trying to work through that. Anyway, don't need to tell our listeners about all of those material exigencies, but one of the things that, you know, that true and false liberty seems to indicate something about what you were asking about fictions of self-determination.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because the idea is that we think if we get an idea that we should be able to follow it without regard to the consequence to other people. At least this is the view of certain individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a lot of that in our world, especially where people get power before they have the maturity to be able to handle it. And that has happened ever and anon throughout our history.
Sure. Well, it happens in all career areas, probably.
Sure.
To greater or lesser extent.
Yeah.
But that kind of falls on the, you know, they do these pairings, comparing true liberty with false liberty. So that was kind of the negative side would be the consort of self-admiration. So
yeah,
what was the phrase they used earlier about the self-determination? Yeah, fictions of self-determination. So, you know, we could see that false liberty, true to false liberty, assumption of self-assertion. So that would be an example of that, I guess. Self-admiration tends towards the exploitation of others. You know, that would be part of that too. So these are the ways that self-determination can go astray into realms that are unreal. And that's what makes them fictitious, I think. Kind of the big message through this whole true and false liberty thing is that true liberty is the path to continuing existence and growth, of course, and ascension, whereas false liberty is the path to self-annihilation and cessation of existence. Eventually, the person is determined to stay on that path. So that's kind of part of the meaning of the fiction, maybe, perhaps, is that it's taking you on a path of non-reality. It's not a real story there. It's a fiction.
Yeah.
Even though it may be a tempting thing, your mind conceives of it, and it may be tempting to try to act it out, but it can't really be lived, you know, in any enduring kind of way. Yeah, that's
right.
Somewhere in the book they talk about how truth can be lived, and that's what we notice about it compared to non-truth or some of these other variety of options they're talking about here that are not, you know, they're not the Father's will for us. They're not the true path forward. It may seem tempting, and the mind can even project a few steps down that path, right? And even take those steps conceivably, but we have to watch out. We have to, you know, be willing to exercise some self-restraint sometimes. Like they say, true liberty is the fruit of self-control. And I think that's an interesting component of it.
You know, one of the interesting aspects of it for me, thinking about this, you know, just musing about it as you're reflecting on some of these things is the idea, you know, what really causes us to drift into these areas of self-assertion and whatnot? And, you know, one area that is actually benign, important, and, you know, really requires to have some latitude of liberty is the idea that you need the power to be creative.
Take risks.
In order to solve certain, take risks to solve certain problems. There's a legitimate need for that. And so that can, when we're in a creative mode trying to solve problems, can get us into some problem if we are not considering the impact of our creative solutions on others. Or just indicating that the creative solution that we have come up with is so brilliant that we ought not to bother considering why it might be a bad idea in the context of thinking about others' personal liberties.
Right.
And I think that
has come
about a long time.
It's like the means and ends.
Rationalization, in other words, knows no bounds.
Right, exactly, right. Or it can be that way.
It can, right.
The human imagination can be the origin of many tempting possibilities, and some are on our path and some aren't. I mean, we just have to learn how to distinguish which is which. I mean, doing the will of the Father is a very tempting possibility.
Yeah.
Even though it takes time and growth to really understand what that even means, I think, and let alone mm-hmm. fulfilling it. But at every step of the way, we can have the intention. We can, you know, do the best we can. So that's kind of the, the, I don't know, the simple formula for staying on the path.
Right.
But you're right. You know, if you're minded or motivated or nature of your personality or endowments to be creative, or you want to experiment, you want to try things or even create things that haven't been created before, that's potentially to be celebrated. You know, initiative and originality are two of the things that Jesus talked about a lot. But being mindful of what your creations are going to, their impact on other people is, it's got to be part of that. You know, recognizing this, what they sometimes they call it like fraternal obligations. You know, there's a sense of being in a web of relationships with others, and you don't want to damage the web while you're doing your experiments with dynamite. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there, I mean, there's realms to that where it can get tricky. You know, we really have to, like, give careful consideration to things. Maybe go mm-hmm. outside of town to do your dynamite experiment. I don't know. I'm just throwing that
yeah.
out as a metaphor. Anyway.
Well, was there another thing that you wanted to talk about with regard to this paper? Or
The main one we're reading?
Right.
About the Lennon Index? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're, you know, really making it clear to us that, you know, where they say all the way into paradise, the ascending pilgrims pursue their studies in the practical schools of applied knowledge. This is a little interesting piece in there, how they describe that. Actual training in really doing the things they're being taught. The universe educational system sponsored by the Melchizedeks is practical, progressive, meaningful, and experiential. It embraces training in things material, intellectual, moral, and spiritual. So there's that balance. It reminds me of a comment I saw recently about on the Mansion Worlds, where the schools are divided into schools of thinking, the schools of feeling, and the schools of doing, I think is how they put it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of similar, you know, feeling, thinking, and doing, thinking, and feeling, however you arrange them. There's a triad there that seems patterned after the, you know, the major triad of matter, mind, and spirit, which is coming up here as well, talking about these Lennonidex schools, this idea of actual training and really doing the things they're being taught. Wow. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, this... living on this world is kind of like that, except we have to, well, oftentimes teach ourselves. But the only way to make progress is to actually try out and do the things that you think are your best idea, whatever it may be, for how to take the next step. You know, there's always that decision point. Okay, what's the next step? What do I do next? And, you know, we're not held in the embrace of visible superhuman teachers and presence. So we really have to do a lot of inner work to get the kind of, you know, actual training sometimes that we need. I mean, certainly reach out into the world too to find the best wisdom we can. But there's that interaction, you know, between what might be available as input externally and what feels right or seems true internally. And what matches our maybe previously received picturizations of destiny, you know, from the adjuster, which I think can sometimes be career shaping for a lot of people, even if they're not totally conscious of it. They just get a good feeling about, yeah, I really want to be a landscape designer, whatever it is, you know. And they can almost picture themselves doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to master a whole bunch of things to make that happen, so that all becomes valuable life experience. Anyway, but this idea that we've got a lot of training ahead, I guess is the main thing I kind of pulled out of that.
And a lot of training, a lot of learning.
A lot in some other places too, where even Lucifer whined about that. Spent so much time training him in administrative, however you put that, principles or practices, and here they are, just like they were before. I don't know. I can't remember exactly how he put it. But he did point to the huge amount of administrative training that's part of the Ascension career, kind of derisively, as I recall. But
yes, he did.
I don't know.
Yeah, that was in the Lucifer Rebellion paper. That was in his manifesto. It was paper 53, section 3, and paragraph 6. The attack upon the universal plan of ascendant mortal training. Lucifer maintained that far too much time and energy were expended upon the scheme of so thoroughly training ascending mortals in the principles of universe administration, principles which he alleged were unethical and unsound. He protested against the age-long program for preparing the mortals of space for some unknown destiny and pointed to the presence of the Finality Corps on Gerasim as proof that these mortals had spent ages of preparation from some destiny of pure fiction. With derision, he pointed out that the Finaliters had encountered a destiny no more glorious than to be returned to humble spheres similar to those of their origin. He intimated that they had been debauched by overmuch discipline and prolonged training, and that they were in reality traitors to their mortal fellows, since they were now cooperating with the scheme of enslaving all creation to the fictions of a mythical eternal destiny for ascending mortals. He advocated that ascenders should enjoy the liberty of individual self-determination. He challenged and condemned the entire plan of mortal ascension as sponsored by the Paradise Sons of God and supported by the Infinite Spirit.
And weren't those Jerusalem finalities? I mean, they're probably the most loyal of all the beings caught up in the rebellion. Or at least they say that
right,
about the Jerusalem citizens.
Yeah, they say that about the
Jerusalem citizens. Lucifer's talking about finalities, I guess. That would apply to them too, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, well, the finalities come back, and
obviously
he can witness that the finalities, he sees the finalities, but saying, okay, so these progressed all the way up along, and now they're coming back to to deal with some of the same things they dealt with on the way up, or that would be his assertion or something. Anyway,
it
clearly was a spurious argument. Based on ignorance, because he wouldn't be knowledgeable about that ascension plan beyond the local universe as to what they were learning.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And his arguments didn't influence them. He didn't persuade any of them to join his rebellion.
Right.
So maybe his message were more for the upcoming ascenders who are still like considering the whole thing. I don't know. But that message, though, of how did he put it? Personal liberty. They would only assert their, what was it? Anyway, that idea of deciding for yourself beyond the bounds of administrative restraint seems to be what he's talking about here. There, but we don't really feel that the same way on this world. I mean, we have laws, you know, obviously laws on purpose and take the risk is the advantage of things that can bring them. So maybe that would be similar in some ways. to what he's talking about there.
Yeah.
But personal liberty, well, that's the whole, that's what's at issue here. What is, and it actually, oops, it reminds me of this one quote that I always love to bring up, if I can find it really quick. It kind of ties in with what they're saying about the Lennon Index.
In the meantime,
Sorry, I thought I could find it more quickly.
Well, not at all, not at
so
all.
So here, I found it.
You got it. Okay, what's the quote?
This. Yeah, let me just turn. Yeah, this is 132.310. I'm sorry.
132.310. Got it.
Right, right. Where they say that, and this is, I guess, the midway is making this comment. Universe progress is characterized by increasing personality freedom because it is associated with the progressive attainment of higher and higher levels of self-understanding and consequent voluntary self-restraint. The attainment of perfection of spiritual self-restraint equals completeness of universe freedom and personal liberty. There's just a lot wrapped up in that that I think is tied to what we were reading in the other paper about true and false liberty.
You might read the rest of that paragraph.
Okay,
yeah,
sure. Yeah,
that's a good. That's an interesting paragraph.
Yeah. Okay. And then it goes on to say that faith fosters and maintains man's soul in the midst of the confusion of his early orientation in such a vast universe, whereas prayer becomes the great unifier of the various creations of the creative imagination and the faith urges of the soul trying to identify itself with the spirit ideals of the indwelling and associated divine presence. So that's,
yeah,
you know, we got faith and we got prayer unifying. Well, the unifier, this is interesting, unifier of the various inspirations of the creative imagination. See, that's the thing. It's almost like the Lennon Index, you know, being created with this range of possible action. You know, sort of like that with us, this comment here about our creative imagination. You know, we can imagine all kinds of things. We can imagine, oh, I could do this. Oh, I could do that, you know. And those need to be unified and made part of a, you know, a greater purpose, I think. It's sort of what's between the lines here. And to really accomplish that, we need, you know, some degree of voluntary self-restraint. We have to, like, stop and think. We don't just, like, do whatever we feel like at any given moment, you know, like a bull in a china shop. So the you know, but the counterintuitive thing in there seemingly maybe, is this idea that self-restraint yields greater liberty. How does that work? Because from the Lucifer perspective, they're, you know, they're separated. Liberty is just something you seize for yourself, right, supposedly. Whereas here they're talking about it as an achievement that follows from having mastered, you know, some of these, you know, it's the self-mastery, conquest of the self, in a sense, enables this degree of self-restraint that can then bring us greater freedom and personal liberty. So, I don't know. It's just so interesting how that works together.
Yeah, they're really almost, trying to give us a
it's
sense.
Almost the exact opposite of Lucifer's message. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, that our character formation is so important whereas it doesn't seem like self-restraint is important, it is important in order to be able to get to the point of you know.
Having
true freedom. I mean, I think that point is made very clearly in paper 54 in various places, that true liberty comes from that voluntary self-restraint that is being talked about here.
Well, if anyone has ever broken their hand punching the wall because they're so angry about something, you might reflect afterwards, damn, I wish I had a little more self-restraint because now I got a broken hand and that's curtailing my freedom. I don't know. You know, just like the self-restraint, you know, on the human level, I think often applies to like impulsive or compulsive actions that, you know, are sometimes hard to resist, particularly when, you know, like anger and things get involved. You know, like look at road rage incidents, or people just do insane things just because they're so enraged. You know, they've completely lost their self-restraint and swept up in this passion of the moment that ends up being very self-destructive. Or just destructive in general.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you know, we have these physical passions and possibilities, sort of part of our nature as human beings. So, we have to kind of learn how to manage some of those things. It's not always easy. You know, human passions can be very powerful, or whatever you want to call those kind of impulses.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear if you can manage them and kind of have a more of a purposeful, forward-moving engagement with life that benefits from that kind of self-restraint, you can see how that then leads into new realms of possibility that you wouldn't be able to reach before otherwise. Part of the freedom and liberty, the things they're talking about, are the opportunities, in a sense, that are opened up by voluntary self-restraint. Well, and then that's paired, of course, with self-understanding and consequent voluntary. So you understand yourself, you figure yourself out. Said, oh, no, that was a bad idea. I'm not going to do that again, right? It's like you understand this thing about yourself from some experience you had. And then consequent to that, you realize, okay, I'm going to restrain that in the future. You know, that's often how we learn, even if it's out of a crisis, maybe you created some huge unnecessary crisis in your life by doing something stupid, right? Raise your hands if anybody's ever had that experience.
Unfortunately, I continue to learn, quote unquote, by experience. I wish I was learning more by looking rather than leaping, but there's still plenty of mistakes to be made on this world.
Yeah. Well, and some of our experiments, you know, you're doing your best, but it just doesn't work out, you know. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's all range of possibilities. But
yeah.
But anyway, so it just kind of brings up all the same issues about self-mastery and, you know, how we get there. And a lot of it goes on in relationships, actually, I think. The kind of learning they're talking about here. We're really, I think, most challenged oftentimes in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're important, even if they're difficult.
Yeah. We're under the last 10 minutes of our show, and it's probably...
Okay.
A little too late to begin anything new. We will take up paper 36 next week, the life carrier paper. But what occurred to me is something that would be interesting in the context of the Lonan Index is to end with a good Lonan Index. I don't know whether we did this on a previous program.
Oh, yeah. You want to read about Lanaforge? You want to read about
I
Lanaforge?
Do. I
yeah,
do.
Yeah. Let's do that.
I
He's
think
our
that's,
guy.
That's the way to end this and to remind
perfect.
Ourselves of a good system sovereign.
Yeah,
do you
that's
want to read this or shall
two.
I?
45,
yeah,
45 two, three.
Two, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, go for it. Why don't you read it?
Okay. I'll start with paragraph two. In Satania, even
okay.
after this disastrous upheaval, absolutely no changes have been made in the technique of system administration. The present system sovereign possesses all the power and exercises all the authority that were invested in his unworthy predecessor, except for certain matters now under the supervision of the Constellation Fathers, which the Ancients of Days have not yet fully restored to Lanaforge, the successor of Lucifer. The present head of Satania is a gracious and brilliant ruler, and he is a rebellion-tested sovereign. When serving as an assistant system sovereign, Lanaforge was faithful to Michael in an earlier upheaval in the universe of Nevadon. This mighty and brilliant lord of Satania is a tried and tested administrator. At the time of the second system rebellion in Nevadon, when the system sovereign stumbled and fell into darkness, Lanaforge, the first assistant to the erring chief, seized the reins of government and so conducted the affairs of the system that comparatively few personalities were lost, either on the headquarters worlds or on the inhabited planets of that unfortunate system. Lanaforge bears the distinction of being the only primary Lunanodet son in all Nevadon who thus functioned loyally in the service of Michael and in the very presence of the default of his brother of superior authority and antecedent rank. Lanaforge will probably not be removed from Gerasim until all the results of the former folly have been overcome and the products of rebellion removed from Satania. Well, all the affairs of the isolated world
yeah.
of Satania... Go ahead.
No, I said go ahead, yeah. Go ahead.
While all the affairs of the isolated worlds of Satania have not been returned to his jurisdiction, Lanaforge discloses great interest in the welfare, and he is a frequent visitor on Urantia. As in other and normal systems, the sovereign presides over the system council of world rulers, the planetary princes, and the resident governors general of the isolated worlds. This planetary council assembles from time to time on the headquarters of the system when the sons of God come together. Once a week, every 10 days on Gerasim, the sovereign holds a conclave with some one group of the various orders of personalities domiciled on the headquarters world. These are the charmingly informal hours of Gerasim, and they are never to be forgotten occasions. On Gerasim, there exists the utmost fraternity between all the various orders of beings and between each of these groups and the system sovereign. These unique assemblages occur on the Sea of Glass, the great gathering field of the system capital. They are purely social and spiritual occasions, nothing pertaining to the planetary administration or even to the ascendant plan is ever discussed. Ascending mortals come together at these times merely to enjoy themselves and to meet their fellow Jerusalemites. Those groups which are not being entertained by the sovereign at these weekly relaxations meet at their own headquarters. Well, what's interesting there for me is the idea that the system sovereign, the ruler of 619 worlds, effectively comes and fraternizes with the ascending mortals on the Sea of Glass, you know, once a year or once every couple of years or however long that takes to have that your group be entertained.
Well, here it says once a week, every 10 days.
Well, they say once a week, some group. So.
Oh, yeah, right.
Even
it wouldn't be part of it.
As ascending mortals, how many groups are there to fraternize with?
Right,
I don't know.
Right. It might not be weekly for us, right? Yeah.
Well, right. We do have our gatherings, just not always with the system sovereign. And But the fact that the system sovereign does meet with each group is instructive.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, utmost fraternity between all the various groups of beings. That's fun to think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
From our evolving mortal perspective, you know, learning to socialize with higher beings is going to be part of our growth, I think. Pretty kind. I don't know. They might make fun of us, though. I wonder. Well, I'm sure there's a kind sense of humor. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just thinking about the social experience of beings spanning such a range of difference in their created level, their ascendant level, all of that. To have that be a fraternal and enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of implications behind that in terms of the character, you know, either is created or developed, you know, that we discover, the qualities of character that we discover in our ascending career. It's fun to think about, you know, the inspirational beings that we might meet, you know, oh, wow, I want to be like him, or I want to be like her. How did she get to be so cool?
Well, we're at the end of our study. I wanted to get a moment just to remind people that Marvin is speaking in about 2 minutes. If you have that, if you are on the distribution for that, I don't know if everybody is. I'm trying to look in the chat and see if anybody has posted on that. Does anybody, if somebody could actually post the UAI notice and the Zoom link in the chat, I'll go ahead and at least read out the Zoom ID to people, and they can then access that. But that begins in about 2 minutes that Marvin is giving a talk on the family of God. And that should be quite enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
And next week, we will take up the life carrier papers and start to look at that fourth local universe Son of God that is very interesting and very versatile in terms of their creation and how they handle life and all the implications of their actions that affect all of us. So that should be a very interesting study.
Yeah, it's a fascinating paper.
Yeah.
There's a lot in it, including as in mind spirits and other important topics.
Well, we thank Robert Zavala, John Schreiner, Isadora Galjur, Gary Tong, Pamela Chaddock, Dee. Don't know your last name, Dee, but I'll call you Diva Art because that's how you represent yourself. Good to see you here, Dee. Good to have you here on there, and Vaughn Fosmo. Nice to have you all listening, and for all of you who listen on the archive, we appreciate you listening to us, and we'll say goodbye for now and see you next week on another edition of The Cosmic Citizen. Thanks very much, Chuck. Goodbye
all
from
right.
Chuck
Thank you, Andre.
And myself, Andre Rodatis.
Yeah, that was fun.
See
all
you
right.
guys next week.
Next week. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.